Welcome to CSEE's This Compassionate Life with Bob Pyle. Bob is a Yale Forestry School graduate and Fulbright Fellow who lives in Grays River in southwest Washington. He founded the Xerces Society, which protects wildlife through the conservation of invertebrates, and has published hundreds of essays and poems and 14 books, one of which won the John Burroughs Award for Distinguished Nature Writing.
Going to ground in Grays River. Walking to the compost this morning, I was arrested by the sight of a leaf pinioned on a rush spike. The bunch of rushes grows in a pot in the corner of the heather garden. The leaf was birch, clear yellow spattered with remnant green. It hung there, impaled as it fell from the tall white wand of the birch. Shivering on the light November air, the leaf was like a moment of grace before the fall. The compost heap shone bright with still more leaves of maple, oak, and hornbeam, spattered among bracts of Brussels sprouts, over the hill red currants, and the collapsed brain pan of a jack-o'-lantern. The exuviae of a satisfied autumn and its festivals. Returning to the house, I paused as always to rinse the white china chamber pot in the spray of a standing spigot. Just before tossing the water onto the heather, I noticed a struggling spider in the chilly swirl. The spiders up spouts suffer a well-known fate, and so it had. But rescued with an oak leaf, it unfolded just fine. When I placed it on the spigot post, I saw a rotund female of another species, a big native orb weaver, hunched up under the handle. The skinnier one crawled back into its shelter, apparently uninjured by the dunking. So the two had been there together at this late date, somehow surviving the harsh frosts and heavy rains of recent mornings. As I approached the back porch, a Steller's Jay rocketed off, screaming that the kibbles were all gone from the cat's dish. An elegant Anderson slug, slender, yellow-rimmed, reticulated, glided away from the bowl, too. From the doorway, I noticed a flutter in a tall English oak by the drive. The first-year Townsend's warblers that had come for Thanksgiving were still there, flickering through the tawny foliage together, while chickadees and kinglets loitered off to the side. The migrant warblers' lemony breasts and faces were as bright as the slug's mantle. Their presence was as unexpected as a pair of spiders in late autumn, their gift as sudden and fleeting as a birch leaf on a rush spike. None of this is high adventure, but it meets my hope for a home where boredom remains at bay. I live where I do so I can look out or walk outside at any time and instantly be within, quote, nature. Of course, one is in nature everywhere, since there is nothing else. But I mean a place where you can actually see all the swallows depart on a certain day in the fall, and see the first arrivals in the spring in all their joy and relief, and know there is nothing sentimental in saying so. See rufous hummingbirds working the sparse nectaries of blood currants while they wait for the salmonberries to break bud. Watch the early vultures ride the airs above the treetops, and the bald eagles, whose nest in a cottonwood top was blown away by last winter's winds, start in again to soar, to hunt, to feed their young in a brand new nest. See the bleeding hearts fan, the trilliums crack, the banana slugs strike out from their cold weather hideaways for fresh pastures of moss, and the fresh spring azures appear on what Robert Frost called Blue Butterfly Day. These things are as important to me as love, and in fact, that's what they are. When I came here to Grays River, this little village, this little almost a hamlet, on a tributary of the Lower Columbia River, about 32 years ago, it was for just that reason. I had lived a largely urban life, although I'd been living in many wonderful places such as New Guinea and the Rocky Mountains, but always back to the city for a job. And though I love urban nature, and I don't find any contradiction in that phrase, still I wanted to be in a place where I could walk outdoors at any time, as I said in that passage, and there would be the lives of others all around me. Now, you can't live anywhere without that being the case, but it's a little more subtle in the city. I wanted to be in a place where I could live and to know that there was the possibility of discovery all the time. That when I went outside, I might hear a bird song that I didn't know, or I might see something in the sky, insect or bird or climate pattern that I was unfamiliar with. Or if I was familiar with it, I wanted to be able to become more familiar day by day by day, every year, and reject the idea of the contempt of the familiar. I wanted to become deeply familiar with the place more and more and more every day as long as I lived there. And I think that's what Grays River and this particular old homestead, Swede Park, has been for me all this time. And there's never a day here when I'm not surprised. But that's true wherever I am, and I think I've cultivated that habit here. I mean, I think it came to me early. But one has to, I think almost actively at some point, take on the common habit of many people that that with which we are very familiar becomes uninteresting any longer. And that with which we're not very familiar is either intimidating or frightening or invisible. I think there was a time when everyone had to be a good naturalist or not survive. I mean, everyone had to be familiar with the local fauna and flora and its uses in order to remain safe from any predators, in order to remain fed. It's been a long time since we traded what Sally Tisdale, Northwest writer, adroitly called our mammalian vigilance for comfort and security. Unlike every other species of animal except our domestics, we no longer have the ability to shuck and jive and move around the countryside at will, unimpeded and unencumbered by our own devices. And therefore, our own devices, and I'm not talking about just contemporary electronic devices, but all devices of our manufacture, tend to get between us and the rest of the natural world. And that's what I was hoping to leave behind as much as possible by coming here to, I mean, I don't live a primitive life. I take part in contemporary culture at a level that I find comfortable and appropriate. But nonetheless, I like to be able to go out of doors and say, what's here? What's here today? What will we find today? And not have that mediated necessarily by information or tools. This works anywhere you go, actually. It doesn't have to be your own backyard. You don't have to live with backdoor access to nature, so to speak. I've just been in Australia for 3 weeks, and just before that I was in China for 3 weeks, and I've been in absolutely extraordinary landscapes in the past month and a half, and I have also been in the densest human population on Earth, in cities way over 20 million. And I've been in deep wilderness, both in China and in Australia. And it actually works anywhere if one can train one's attention outside one's own personal comfort and needs on other organisms and other things happening around you. Then you have the ability for this eternal source of refreshment and engagement and delight.
In your book, The Thunder Tree, you mentioned that it's the movement of water over territory that makes it a place.
The movement of water over territory. Yes, that phrase means a lot to me, and I really do think it helps to define place and let us know that we're in place. But I'm not sure, had I been born and brought up here in the Pacific Northwest, that the idea would have come to me as readily as it did. Being a resident of the dry Colorado Plains, I was born in Denver and grew up on the eastern arid edges of Denver, where I sought my tangled banks and my intrigue out on an old irrigation ditch east of town. That was where I could escape my suburban grid and go wandering on a watercourse that my brother discovered one day called the Highline Canal. Didn't have water in it all the time, but when there was enough water in the Platte River to allow water into the Highline Canal, then the farmers out on the canal got some water. And when they did, we as boys, as opportunistic organisms roaming the countryside, were able to find lots of life. Because where water occurs, life occurs. And so the butterflies, the birds, the weeds, everything that excited us as boys were to be found along the Highline Canal, especially the water itself, because it was hot in Colorado, and we'd go into the water. We became watery organisms ourselves. So I understood the import of water in the life of someone who cared about landscape very early on, organically, from growing up as an organism in that dry landscape. Now, my mother and my grandmother had grown up or lived in Seattle and elsewhere in Western Washington and had talked about ferns and moss and waterfalls all my young life. And so I was extremely intrigued by the idea of a really wet place with a lot of green. And that's why I came here, and to come up to the University of Washington in 1965, where I found myself immersed in a great deal more water than I ever imagined even existed. And that was in Seattle, which is an arid place compared to where I live now in Grays River, which has four times the rainfall of Seattle. I live in a place with 4 meters of rainfall a year.
Why should we consider water as precious, even in a very wet place?
Now here, it's easy for people to take water for granted. There's a lot of it falling from the sky. It bounces back up from the earth. It's gelid in the skies themselves. And for much of the year, one feels as though there's been quite enough water, thank you very much. And yet, even in such a place as this, we find that water defines the countryside, defines our lives around it, and defines all the lives that dwell upon the land. That old ditch in Colorado became so important to me because, as I said, it concentrated life. It also saved my life. There were galleries of cottonwood trees that grew along those canals. One of those big cottonwoods was hollow. Big, beautiful, hollow cottonwood tree. Quite naturally, it became sort of the center of our young boys' empire, where our games generated. Kids in the United States always, and Canada, I suppose, make forts. Right? That's one of the standard things that children do out of doors when they roam free, if they roam free, as they used to do, was to make forts. The word for it in England is den, and the word for it in Australia, quite delightfully, is cubby. But wherever we make our dens and cubbies and forts, that becomes the center of our immediate home universe. And that, for us, was this big hollow cottonwood tree. And one day, my brother and I were caught out in a devastating hailstorm that ultimately broke the backs of 5 or 6 cattle in the field next to where we were caught ourselves. Broke their backs and crushed their skulls with hail the size of grapefruits and pomelos. This was all researched later on. I didn't make it up in my young boy's imagination. My brother pulled me into the hollow tree. He was 11, I was 7, and it quite literally saved our lives. And so after that hollow tree became even more the center of the universe for us, and the canal even more of our lifeline and our artery, this green umbilicus through the landscape. So when I come here now, many years later, to Grays River, where there's evidence of water all around, and this is, as I said in my book about this area, a wintergreen world, one maybe has to look a little more closely for the meaning of water than one does in an arid land. And yet it's right there. And if we're to walk a couple of hundred yards down from this house, as did the mergansers one day that hatched from a tree hole in the oak right beside us, Tia was lucky enough to see the mergansers crossing the lawn the day that the adults took the young down to the river. And we were able to watch these baby ducks all the way down the slope, across the road, through the field, through the brambles, and plop down into Grays River. Well, they knew exactly what they needed. They had to get from the oak tree to the river, even though they're in a warm, moist place, but they have to get to water itself. We have to actually take water into our bodies, and we have to take it into our hearts as well. When water comes and goes, as it does in a place like this, where the Grays River goes from being a 25-foot artery in the latter part of summer into a quarter-mile-wide flooding valley floor in the middle of winter, and this can happen within a matter of 12 hours, to rise from trickle to torrent, and it can remain that way for 2 or 3 days before it drops back into the banks, then one realizes the hidden power within a watercourse. The fact that those floods have been exacerbated by the logging in the hills over the years so that the hills can no longer hold the water in the sponge that they once were able to causes this effect to be even more pronounced. The fact that the hills can't hold their silt the way they used to be able to do because the roots are dead in so many of the valley faces and the headwalls of the streams, allowing a permanent harvest of silt into the rivers and therefore silting up of the rivers and therefore even greater flooding, makes it even more apparent to us that the water is an ephemeral element. Even in a wet place, the water isn't permanent. It cannot be taken for granted. We're entering now the time of year, which is an almost Mediterranean climate, when even the fields of Grays River go yellowish and sometimes even almost brown, when that stream diminishes to a trickle that would be hard to take a canoe down. And that's the very same river that 6 months hence might be a quarter mile wide and raging and taking buildings and great logs with it. The water, even in a rainforest area such as this, cannot necessarily be relied upon to be consistent. It's not that many years ago when these hills were sprayed aerially with herbicides, and they still sometimes are in places on the private timberlands, to prevent the competing growth from coming up in the Douglas fir plantations. When that kind of spraying reached a certain level of saturation, the women of Alcee, Oregon, back in the 70s, found that they were having a high incidence of birth defects in their children, as well as miscarriages. It went to federal court over 2,4-5-T, which turned out to be much the same substance as Agent Orange in Vietnam. And it was banned on the federal lands after that and on the state lands. The private companies still use not 2,4-5-T or Agent Orange, but they still use chemicals bearing 2,4-D, which many people believe to be absolutely harmless, but it's not. It's still related to a lot of reproductive ills when it gets into people's bodies. And so you see it's a fine line. These hills now around us are far less sprayed than they used to be, and there's no evidence that the spray is getting into the river. But I'm not sure I would have wanted to drink the water from Grays River back in the 1950s and 60s and 70s when there was a lot of that spray going into the hills above us. So the quality of the water is potentially transient. The supply of the water is potentially ephemeral. And then, too, there's the aesthetic, soulful quality of the water, which changes by the moment. Here in Grays River, I've spent 32 years looking down at the river and looking at it rising in the mists and flowing down its course and changing day by day by day. I try to never take this river for granted. There have been plans to put a dam upstream. Well, Grays River is one of the last free-flowing rivers of its size and consequence in western Washington that has no dams on it anywhere. And such a thing would, of course, dramatically change the nature of this river. Different interests in this valley would like to treat the river in different ways. Some would like to dredge it. Some would like to riprap it in certain places to control the erosion on certain sites. And in some cases, that might even be advisable with respect to the salmon and the loss of the fields and so on. I would not say that no human interference is the way to go. In fact, human interference is being invoked in a restorative way to remove the old dikes from the rivers in places to allow the natural older, there I go saying natural, to allow the original function of the river to restore itself. So humans do have a role in the watershed, no doubt about it. But the first thing they need to do is to recognize their dependency upon not only this river, but the larger river that flows into the Columbia River, and the water cycle that I write about in the Thunder Tree, remembering back to the old movie I watched in junior in elementary school of Willie Waterdrop. Willie Waterdrop rises with the mist and goes up into the skies and eventually falls at the headwater of the river, and we follow Willie Waterdrop's progress all down the watercourse, through the dams and down through the polluted sections and ultimately down to the ocean. That made a big impression on me as a child, the progress of Willie Waterdrop down through the entire watershed. All of us are Willie Waterdrop. We're all composed of Willie Waterdrops, and we all rise and fall with the health and the presence of our waters.
Can you describe what the phrase extinction of experience means to you and what it might come to mean to others?
The great, exciting, thrilling time of discovering butterflies for myself along the Highland Canal in Colorado also became a sobering time and a sometimes sad time because it exposed me to the first extinctions that I ever experienced. The first one came in a little fringe of marsh on the edge of town where I found a colony of bronze copper butterflies. And they became extinct in that site the day the Lutherans paved their parking lot. I never saw the bronze copper again in Aurora, Colorado for the 30 years until once In the new edge of town, many years later, after the town had grown way out onto the prairie, I found another colony of them, but they were essentially gone from my childhood experience at that time. And then, the next experience of loss that I suffered had to do with a butterfly called the Olympia marble wing. Beautiful little bit of linen tissue, marbled below with chartreuse with a rosy flush above. An exquisite little butterfly. I found a colony of them just off the edge of the Highland Canal in a patch of wild mustard plants. And I visited them every spring, and it was a great day when they came out. And then one year, a new junior high school was built, which I attended in the first class. The playing fields, and in particular the field that was set aside for the throwing of the discus, was implanted right on top of the colony of Olympia marble wings, and I was a discus thrower. And so my own very other passion of life, throwing the discus, directly supplanted my love of the Olympia marble wings. It was quite ironic, really, because in those early days I had dreams of going to the Olympics someday as a discus thrower. Well, that was certainly far from ever coming to pass, but my real Olympia was there living in that very field until it was replaced by my school. So I saw these extinctions happen around me, and there were a good many others too, as the population of Aurora expanded and ultimately became even greater than the population of Denver itself. A few years later, in graduate school at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, my professor, Charles Remington, who had brought me back there to do a doctorate in the field of butterfly conservation, asked me to give a lecture in his stead at the American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting in Boston in a panel called Wildlife in the Year 2000. This was in the year 1975. I wondered, what can I talk about in Professor Remington's stead? And it occurred to me I could talk about the extinctions that I've experienced and what that means to me. And what it meant to me, I realized, was exactly that, the extinction of experience. And that's when that phrase came into my mind. So I gave that talk, and subsequently I wrote it as an essay, and then later it became the centerpiece essay in my book, The Thunder Tree. Well, I guess the hailstorm is really the centerpiece, but then the essay that sort of holds up the backbone of that book, I think, is called The Extinction of Experience. And what it means is this. When common species, and you could apply this too, by the way, to culture, architecture, art, anything else, but any elements of diversity in our surroundings, but I speak primarily about living species, when these common elements become extinct right around us in what I call our own radius of reach, realizing that our radius of reach is much smaller for the very young, the very old, the disabled, and the poor, when that happens, they might as well become extinct altogether in an existential way as pertains to our experience of them. If we can't go out and see violet-green swallows on our porch or in the park or even any place we can walk to, then those violet-green swallows for us don't even exist. Well, of course they do, and we all are happy to contribute to organizations that protect wilderness that we will never see. Yes, we can abstract the wild. When the wild is concrete to us, when we actually see it, feel it, touch it, smell it, sometimes taste it, right around us, it means so much more. And it actually has an impact on our sensibilities and our spirits, if you will. So when these things become extinct around us, people tend to become less engaged, more alienated from nature, that is, less acquainted with the intimate contact that they might have had with nature, and therefore less caring. You care about what you know. And what you care about, you conserve. And therefore, people become less cognizant of loss, more apathetic, less activist, and therefore, more losses occur, which causes even greater alienation. So you see, it's a cycle. The extinction of experience is a particularly vicious cycle that results in increasing losses. So it goes on and on. The extinction of experience, sucking the life from the land, the intimacy from our connections. This is how the passing of otherwise common species from our immediate vicinities can be as significant as the total loss of rarities. People who care conserve. People who don't know don't care. What is the extinction of a condor to a child who has never known a wren? When children no longer get dirt under their nails and nature under their skin, then a connection fades. A particular concern on this score for me is the loss of children's ability to roam and to explore. I call it the freedom of the day. How many of you had an experience or experiences in a place, a particular place that mattered to you, that made you care about the land in the early part of the Thunder Tree? I say, when people connect with nature, it happens somewhere. Almost everyone who cares deeply about the outdoors can identify a particular place where contact occurred. Now, this may have been a wilderness, a national park, or a stretch of unbounded countryside. But more often, the place that makes a difference is unspectacular. A vacant lot, a scruffy patch of woods, a weedy field, a stream, a green ravine, or a ditch. In fact, vacant lot is my favorite oxymoron. What's less vacant to a curious kid than a vacant lot? So I say, you know, what is the place that you went to? You know, not your family vacations to Yellowstone or to the beach. No, I'm talking about that back 40 or that grandma's backyard or that particular tree or bump on the land or rock or ditch where you went and where you went with your friends either to get away from the girls or get with the girls or boys, vice versa. The things we did, we skipped rocks on water and we built forts or cubbies, they say in Australia, or we caught things. We caught bugs, and we caught crawdads, and we caught butterflies. And we did a little bit of clabber and damage out there, and we engaged and we explored. When that engagement with the countryside, no matter how narrowly you define the countryside, ceases to be a common part of people's existence, what do we learn in terms of exploration, in terms of adaptation, in terms of the growth of the curious spirit and the questioning mind, in terms of sociality with our friends with whom we do these things? Now, I believe the impulse remains, and that gives me hope. I was in the Vancouver Mall one night. Indoors, there was a water feature, a rectangular travertine water feature with a rubber tree that might have been rubber and it might have been a rubber tree. I'm not sure, but it was this artificial place. And here were the kids skipping stones on the water. But they weren't stones. They were quarters that they'd recovered from the fountain, and they were skipping them on the water like stones. And I said, did you learn that down at your local creek or pond? You know, you're pretty good at that. And they said, no, man. We don't have any place like that, dude. They said, we just come here to do it. And at the same time, my heart broke because they don't have a pond. They don't have any water in their lives. They have to come to the mall. And my heart burst with hope that they still want to do this. They still want to skip stones in the water. And as long as those impulses survive, the possible re-engagement of kids can go forth.